An hour before dawn, Job came back down the column to find Sean.
"We aren't going to reach our first objective until an hour or so after first light," he reported. "The pace has been slower than we expected. What do you want us to do? Shall we take a chance on the Hinds finding us?"
Sean looked up at the sky before he replied. The first lemon-coloured flush of dawn was paling out the stars.
"The forest roof isn't dense enough to hide so many men and so much equipment," he decided. "We have to keep going and get them into hiding. Tell Matatu to quicken the pace."
"What about the Hinds?"
"The main fighting is well behind us now. That's where they will be headed. We have to take the chance, but move fast."
As the light strengthened, so the faces of the men in the long column turned more frequently and fretfully to the sky. The pace was fast, almost a run. Although they had been going all night, still the Shanganis bore their heavy burdens with all the hardiness and fortitude of the African, burdens that would have broken the heart and the back of even a strong white man. It was light enough to define the treetops against the orange blossom of dawn when Sean heard the dread whistle of turbos, faint and distant, passing to the east. The Hinds were flying their first sortie of the day, and the alarm was shouted down the length of the column. The porters dived off the path, seeking the nearest cover, and the section leaders crouched, ready to wave the captured Frelimo colours that Sean had provided for each of them, should the Hinds spot them and come in to strafe them. The deception was not necessary, for the pair of Hinds passed 2 miles east of their position. Sean saw their silhouettes like deformed gnats, black against the oncoming dawn. A minute later, heard the thunder of their Gatling cannons and the boom of their assault rockets as they pounded another Renamo stronghold amongst the ironstone hills far behind them. Sean got the column moving again, and the glimpse that they had been given of the flying death sped their feet. An hour later, the tail end of the column clambered swiftly down the almost sheer side of the gorge, at the bottom of which lay the dry riverbed and the caves where the captured Unimogs had been hidden. It was almost a homecoming, and the men crept thankfully into the gloom of the caverns and laid down the heavy packs.
"No fires," Sean ordered. "No smoking."
They ate their rations of cold, stodgy maize cakes and dried fish, and then curled on the cavern floor and slept like a pack of hounds exhausted at the end of a day's hunting. Sean found a private place for Claudia at the back of the cavern, behind a natural screen of tumbled sandstone blocks. He spread a blanket on the rocky floor, and she sat cross-legged upon it and munched the unappetizing rations. But before she had half finished, she slumped sideways, asleep, before her head touched the floor. Sean spread the other blanket over her, for it was chilly in the depths of the cavern, and then he went back to the entrance. Alfonso had rigged the antenna of the small portable two-way VHF radio. He was crouched beside the set with the volume turned low, listening to the situation reports of the Renamo field commanders as they reported in to General China's headquarters.
"It goes very badly," he told Sean glumly. "Frelimo will be on the riverbank by noon tomorrow, and unless the general pulls back, he will be overrun."
Alfonso broke off as he recognized their call sign in the jumbled static of the wave band.
"Banana bush, this is Warthog,"
he replied into the hand mic, and then gave the primary objective established code.
"Coca-Cola."
Sean smiled at this subtle commentary on modern Africa, and Banana Bush acknowledged and signed off. The next report was scheduled for dawn tomorrow, by which time the fate of the mission would be decided, one way or the other. Sean left Alfonso rolling up the antenna and packing the radio into its carrying case, and from the entrance of the cavern watched the party of 5 men who, under Job's supervision, were sweeping the sandy riverbed with thorn branches to obliterate the last traces of their passing. Job climbed back to the mouth of the cave, and Sean asked,
"Sentries?" "On each of the peaks."
Job pointed to the heights above them.
"I've covered every approach."
"All right." Sean led him back into the cavern. "It's time to arm and program the stingers."
It took almost a full hour to assemble the launchers, connect the battery packs, and feed the cassettes into the microcomputers in the consoles. Finally, each of the launchers was fully armed and programmed for two-color attack sequence on the hind gunships, and they handed them back to the Shangani section leaders. Sean glanced at his wristwatch, mildly surprised that it was still keeping time after all the abuse he had given it recently.
"We can grab a few hours shut-eye," he told Job.
But neither of them made a move to do so. Instead, as if by consent, they moved back to the entrance of the cavern, away from the others, and leaned against the rock wall with their shoulders almost touching, staring thoughtfully out into the riverbed, where the early sunlight was sparkling the crystalline sand like powder snow.
"If you'd taken my advice, you could be living high in the fleshpots of Harare now," Sean murmured. "And never have the chance to bag a hind?"
Job smiled carefully. His damaged lip was crusted with a fragile scab, and a drop of blood, like a tiny ruby, appeared as it split open again. He dabbed at it with a corner of his bandana as he went on.
"We've hunted all the dangerous game together, Sean, in all the worst places. Buffalo in the Jesse Bush, elephant in the Kasagasaga. This will be another trophy, the best and biggest."
Sean turned to study his face. It was typical of their friendship that their feelings should be so perfectly in tune. During the long night march, Sean's fury and hatred of General China had abated and given way to this emotion, which Job had just articulated, the excitement of the hunter. They were both hunters. The chase was fire and a passion in their blood which they had never attempted to suppress. They understood each other, recognized and accepted this bond between them, which had grown stronger over the 20 years of their friendship. Yet they had seldom spoken of their feelings for each other, Sean realized.
"Perhaps now is the time to do so," he thought, and said aloud, "We are more than brothers, you and me."
"Yes," Job replied simply.
"We are beyond the love of brothers."
They were silent then, not embarrassed by what had passed between them, but rather fulfilled and fortified by it.
"As a brother," Sean broke the silence, "may I ask a favour of you?"
Job nodded, and Sean went on softly. "There will be hard fighting at the lager. I would not want Claudia to fall into the hands of Frelimo if I were not there to prevent it. That is the favour I ask." A shadow passed behind Job's eyes.
"I do not like to think about that possibility."
"If I am not there, will you do it for me?" Job nodded.
"I give you my word."
"If you have to do it, do not warn her, do not speak. Do it unexpectedly."
"She will not know it is coming," Job promised. "It will be quick."
"Thank you," Sean said and clasped his shoulder. "Now we must rest." Claudia was still asleep. Her breathing was so gentle and silent that for a moment Sean was alarmed. He put his face close to hers and felt the warmth of her breath on his cheek. He kissed her, and she murmured in her sleep and reached out, fumbling for him, and sighing contentedly as he crept into the circle of her arms. He seemed only to have closed his eyes for a moment before a light touch on his cheek woke him again, and he looked up to see Job squatting over him.
"It's time."
Job's lips formed the words, and Sean gently disentangled Claudia's arms.
"Sleep sweetly, my love," he murmured, and left her lying on the blanket.
The others were already waiting for him at the entrance of the cave. Matatu and Alfonso and the section leaders, only lightly armed so that they could move swiftly and stealthily.
4 o'clock,
Job told Sean, and he saw that the light in the riverbed had mellowed. The shadows were lengthening. There was nothing more to say. They had both done this half 100 times before.
"See you around," Job said,
and Sean nodded as he strapped on his pack.
With Mutatu dancing ahead of them like a forest sprite, they slipped out of the cavern and into the trees, turning immediately south and settling into their running formation. Twice they heard the Hind gunships passing at a distance, and once they were forced into cover as one of the helicopters came directly overhead. However, it was high, over 4,000 feet, Sean estimated, flying at the top of its speed. Studying the aircraft through his binoculars, Sean guessed it had completed a mission and was racing back to the lager to refuel and rearm. To confirm this, he saw that the racks of the swatter assault missiles below the fuselage were empty, and the nozzles of the rocket pods were scorched with a black blast of discharged rockets. The Hind was heading on exactly the same bearing as Mutatu was leading them, and even as Sean held it in the field of his binoculars, the Hind reduced power on its turbos and commenced its descent, homing in on its lager. "Not more than 5 miles ahead," Sean guessed, and glanced across at Mutatu, who was waiting expectantly for Sean's approbation.
"Like a bee to its hive," Mutatu grinned.
"Your eyes are like those of the vulture," Sean agreed. "They see all."
And Mutatu hugged himself with pleasure and rocked on his haunches. Sean's praise was all the reward he ever asked for. Half an hour later, they leopard-crawled up into the crest of a low, rocky koppie and slid over the skyline into the dead ground below, before Sean raised his binoculars. He used his cap to shade the lens. A reflected ray of sunlight would telegraph their position like a heliograph. He picked up the railway line immediately, less than 2 miles distant. The ballast was of blue granite, and the single set of tracks gleamed dully in the late sunshine, polished by the steel wheels of rolling stock. He followed the tracks for a mile and found the spur onto which 2 railway tankers had been shunted. They were partially hidden by scraggly trees and rank bush, but minutes later a feather of dust rose out of the forest and a fuel buzzer came down a dirt track and pulled in beside the leading tanker. Sean watched through the binoculars as overall-clad workers connected up the delivery hose and began pumping fuel between the 2 vehicles. While this was happening, a Hind gunship rose with dramatic suddenness from the foreslope of the hill, just beyond the railway spur. And at last, Sean had a positive fix on the lager. The Hind rose to 300 feet above the hill and then turned and bore away, humpbacked and nose-heavy, for one more mission over the battlefield in the north before the light failed and the fighting was suspended for the night. Now that he knew exactly where to look, Sean was able to make out other heavily camouflaged emplacements on the slopes of the hill. He counted 6 of them and said so to Mutatu.
"There are 2 more.
Mutatu grinned patronizingly as he pointed out the hidden emplacements that Sean had overlooked.
"And there are 3 more on the far side of the hill. You cannot see them from here."
The wisdom of making this reconnaissance in daylight became clearer as Sean was able to pick out the discrepancies between the model with which they had planned the raid and the actual topography of the lager and its surroundings. Sean jotted the amendments in his notebook, making new estimates of the ranges and the fields of fire that his missiles could command. One by one, he called over each of the section leaders and pointed out exactly what positions he wanted them to occupy as soon as their teams arrived and darkness had fallen to cover them. Satisfied that Mutatu could supply no further information, Sean dispatched him. "Go back to Job. As soon as it's dark, guide him and all the other soldiers up here.